This hour of the exchange will take us into the future. Well, 1 hour for sure, but perhaps better equipped for the hours and years that follow. We have to be honest with ourselves. Science fiction leads us to expect big things of the future, sometimes sooner than the world is able to deliver. Just listen to this.
It is the year 2000, but where are the flying cars? I was promised flying cars. I don't see any flying cars. Why?
That's the actor Avery Brooks with a tongue-in-cheek IBM ad about flying cars from 2000. 17 years later, we still don't have those, but we do have self-driving cars on the roads now. Is that a good thing or not? Those are among the questions our next guests ask in the book, The Driver in the Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create the Future. Vivek Wadhwa somehow finds time to write books despite appointments at Carnegie Mellon University and Duke University, where he is the director of research at the engineering school. Vivek also writes columns for The Washington Post. Vivek Wadhwa, thank you for joining us on The Exchange.
No, thanks for having me on. By the way, Alex helps me with the books. That's why I can be productive.
Okay, that's what it is. Alex Salkiever is with us as well. He's Vice President of Marketing Communications at Mozilla, as in Firefox. He was a regular science writer for the Christian Science Monitor and was a technology editor at Business Week. Alex, thank you for joining us.
I'm really glad to be here. Thank you.
So, Vivek, there's one university I didn't mention here, Singularity University. What is that?
Singularity is a futuristic think tank in Silicon Valley. It's and on the NASA base, founded by Peter Diamandis and Ray Kurzweil, who is considered to be the greatest futurist of our time. It's these futuristic thinkers who believe that we're going to be able to uplift mankind and become one with computers and so on. It's amazing stuff, but also sometimes in the realm of science fiction. But these people think very far out, and they're making a lot of good things happen.
Now, Vivek, you seem to see the future as a choice between two movies, and which two would those be?
Mad Max, a.k.a. Donald Trump. I'm just kidding. And Star Trek.
So one is a utopia where a lot of needs are taken care of, and the other one is a post-apocalyptic hellscape.
Yes, I see really us, at this junction right now, where we could build the amazing Star Trek future literally 300 years ahead of schedule, or we could descend into dystopia and have us rip each other apart. I mean, if you look at what's happening already in America, that's why I made the snide remark, because I see us now, the gap between the haves and the have-nots widening. And when I say haves and have-nots, it's not only money like it used to be, it's also technology, it's also culture, values, it's all widening. And I worry about what's going to happen to, not only to America, but to the world, unless we make the right choices.
Is technology not fairly evenly distributed, though? It seems like even people who don't make a lot of money still find a way to afford smartphones.
But, if you look at what's happening now with this country, and if you look at what happened in France, you have people who are using technology differently and people who fear it. So even though everyone has smartphones, the way they use social media is different. The benefits they get is different, and people are scared of technology. Self-driving cars are going to be amazing, for example, but self-driving cars are going to put millions out of work. So on the one hand, the majority of us benefit. On the other hand, a minority suffer, and that creates the anger and the resentment. So the question is, what choices do we make here? Do we have these? Do we not have these? Do we now, become dependent on these technologies? Do we now create new risks, which are, we can talk more about the risks, but every technology has a good and a bad side, good and evil at the same time. We have to figure all of this stuff out. We have to understand it.
Alex Salkiever,
I wanted to add just one thing on this too. Sorry to interrupt. But I think technology is less evenly distributed than we recognize. So, for example, many of the people listening to this are probably in communities where broadband access is limited or poor. And in New York City, one-third of the people who live there, actually have irregular broadband access. So even in the U.S., everybody has a cell phone, but and a lot of other things, it's not evenly distributed. So sorry to interrupt.
No problem. I wanted to ask you actually about, since you are a guy in the computer business, whether last week the WannaCry virus or the WannaCry virus, whether that adjusted your view of the future, the ransomware.
No, I mean, I think that's much more and more becoming the norm. And Vivek has written about this some as well. As we move towards a future where everything is connected, everything is on the Internet, the Internet of Things is something that is woven into everything we do, then these type of attacks become just part of the fabric, background fabric of our lives. This one just happened to be more widespread, potentially using tools built by the NSA, which, you know, we would hope that they would disclose some of the tools or the vulnerabilities to technology companies to help us defend our users. But in general, I mean, 20 years ago, you did not have small hospitals worrying about getting taken over by a ransomware attack. Now, today, it happens hundreds of times across the country and thousands of times across the world.
You know, I have to ask, too, since I think you're slightly younger than Vivek and I are, whether your choices of movies about the future might differ, your polls of opposites for the future.
So I'm actually not that much younger, but I'll take a compliment. I would think more like Blade Runner would be my representation of a dystopian future where there's still lots of technology, but it's not very well distributed, and the sort of the underclass, particularly in urban areas and other places, is they have not such a great life. Resources are widely unfairly distributed, whereas something that I think might be more utopian. I think Star Trek's a pretty good representation of it. That one to me is a much better sort of sounding board for what I think a great future can be.
All right, we're talking to Alex Salkiever and Vivek Wadhwa, who are the authors of The Driver in the Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create the Future. So we're talking about some of the choices we have to make as we go through. I mean, in other words, having a large-scale discussion about, what are the things we want for the future? And they do provide some guidelines within the book about some questions to ask of things that come along the road that look like they could be good things for us, or we might have some questions about it and some tests to apply to those. Those are going to be contained later in the conversation and later in the book. The Driver in the Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create the Future, back on the Jefferson Exchange with its authors and you, if you'd like to join us by phone or by email, in a minute 30. On the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guests today are the co-authors of the book, The Driver in the Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create the Future. The authors are Vivek Wadhwa, who was a futurist with appointments at Carnegie Mellon and Duke Universities. Alex Salkiever is Vice President of Marketing Communications at Mozilla. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the future and what it might look like. 800-838-3760. And while we're at it, how we can help it look like a certain thing. And your emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. So we did start talking a bit about equality and inequality and uneven distribution of technology. And there's a perspective I want to bring in here. And this is actually from Louis C.K.
Everything is amazing right now and nobody's happy.
You guys have probably heard this one before. Vivek, he means that we have great stuff right now, but we're always complaining about it or using the devices that we have to complain about how bad the world is. How does frustration and dissatisfaction figure in making change happen as we go into the future, Vivek?
We don't seem to understand how far we've come as a race. That today we have fewer wars than ever before. The things we have, running water, air conditioning, cars, smartphones. This is the stuff that kings and queens dreamed about. They didn't have all of these things. We live healthier lives than we ever did before. So by every metric, we're much better off. Yet we don't understand it. We don't appreciate what we have. Now, moving into the future, it's going to be more of the same, that we will now be able to have unlimited food, unlimited energy, unlimited education. And yet we're going to feel left out because we don't understand it. This is what the challenge is. Can we share the prosperity? Can we share the values? Can we now deal with the social unrest that comes from the widening gap from, some people losing their jobs and now being on a new form of social welfare? So a lot of these things it's really humanity. It's human to be unhappy and imperfect, but we should appreciate what we have. Alex, why don't you add to that? Maybe I didn't express myself very well over there. Alex?
No, I think you did a really good job with it, but I think a couple other thoughts around this. So we don't ever presuppose to banish unhappiness or ambition or all the things that are native to the human condition. At the same time, from what Louis C.K. is saying is absolutely correct, because in the technology is somewhat of an expression of materialism, and I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, we all want to have better things, but when that becomes the sole focus of who we are, and it also becomes innately tied to our ability to buy things, to get things, to sort of have better jobs, to make more money, then Vivek and I are starting to question whether that's a future we want versus a future where, the values that we assign to ourselves, what we as a society, see as valuable and what we as ourselves see as valuable can change. In the past and today, it's really tied to the job. Most people, it is sort of keeping, that's how we keep score. In the future, how can we, when technology will probably eliminate a lot of these jobs or at least alter them significantly, how do we keep score? How do we be human in a way that's happier and at peace with the unlimited resources and the unlimited technology capabilities that we see?
Well, and that's a big theme of the book, is that as technology improves and displaces people, because more robots and computers can handle jobs that were done by human beings, you essentially idle more people potentially. And honestly, I'm not sure if what you're talking about, Vivek, is heaven or hell or someplace in between. I mean, you're talking about us all getting fed and educated, but not necessarily working or feeling like we have a purpose.
And that's what really concerns me, because, the purpose of work right now is subsistence. I mean, we're fortunate in California and Oregon and America to have everything we have. So we take it for granted that we have energy. When we come home, we turn the lights on and we can read. We take it for granted that we have clean water. In the rest of the world, billions of people don't have this. When we get sick, even if we can't afford medical care, we can go to the hospital and get emergency treatment. In the rest of the world, you die. I mean, literally, it's that sad. So, in the next 10 or 15 or 20 years or so, we will have the ability to solve all of these problems. This seems like science fiction, but we're headed into an era of unlimited, clean, and almost free energy. I'm talking about now having solar panels and having wind and having the ability now for everyone to have lighting everywhere in the world. I'm talking about now having digital assistants. Our smartphones become our doctors. I'm talking about being able to now cure disease itself, edit it out of our system. So all of these amazing things become possible. However, we don't have the work we had before. So as Alex said, how do we keep score now? We're valued by what we do. When you meet someone, the first thing you ask them is, what do you do? Mm-hmm. And they tell you what they do, and that's how you judge them. Well, when you don't have that way of judging people, what's our new value system? There are models for this. I mean, if you go back, I was born in India. You go back to ancient India, what we valued was knowledge, enlightenment. We valued the arts, humanities. So we could go back to that, but the question is, are we ready for this? Are we ready to start valuing people based on what they contribute to society versus how much money they own?
So it is a fairly optimistic view of the future, but, honestly, when you were starting to say unlimited clean energy, I was wondering if you're going to say unlimited clean water, because we do have some issues like water and food and continued population growth on the planet, and I don't see those mentioned in the book, Vivek.
Just because if you have, clean, you have unlimited energy, you can boil the oceans, literally. Go back to high school. How did we learned about distilled water? What do you have to get to get 100% clean water? You boil the water. So we're surrounded by water. There's water everywhere. The trouble is that the cost of cleaning it has been so high because energy has been so expensive. What happens when the cost of energy drops? You have unlimited clean water. And then you look at the advances in agriculture, in particular vertical farming. That it's with the last 3 or 4 years, there have been major breakthroughs in LED technologies. You can now optimize food growth, plant growth, and have it in sealed containers, in glass containers. The cost here is energy. Everything else is inexpensive because you'll have AI and sensors monitoring the plant growth. So we can now develop the ability to grow food in the cities and have all the food we want. There are also scientists who are working on 3D printing meat. This sounds bizarre, but imagine synthetically producing meat. That's also happening. It's been proven that it can be done. It's still very expensive, but the way technology advances, which is at an exponential pace, give it 5, 10, 15 years, and we will have synthetically produced hamburgers that are, you know, like we have a microwave, you just heat something up. It's literally go to the Star Trek-like replicator, and you 3D print the food that you want. This is all becoming possible. So, this is why the book focused on energy, because once you have energy, you can make all of these things happen.
Yeah, you do suggest looking at the big picture, but I have to ask if we do ever. I mean, we seldom seem to buy big packages of ideas so much as we try this and that, like we cut the cable, we elect a different person to a different rule or something, office. But we don't tend to think in terms of holes, though, do we, Vivek?
No, we don't, and we're highly imperfect, and we don't understand what's happening around us, and so on and so on. So you're making a very good point over here, that we have all of the, you know, these amazing things happening, yet we don't understand them. We don't look at the whole. We don't appreciate what we have. So I can go on and on and on about that, but you're right.
So a question for Alex then here about laws and ethics. I mean, whether they're really even capable of keeping up with technology. You're very close to what goes on in the development of technology, and I just wonder what your thoughts are on whether we can even figure out how to regulate things that we don't even fully understand yet.
So I think it's going to be an ongoing problem as legal systems that were really designed for the paper age struggle to keep up with developments in technology and the moral implications of those technology developments. And you see this manifest in multiple parts of the book. I mean, for example, in genomics, personal medicine, as we start to see treatments come out that are personalized, that can alter people's genes, or treatments that could alter the genes of entire populations. You know, what are the ethics behind that? How do we really regulate that? The FDA is struggling to keep up. They're doing their best, but they can't keep up with the labs, because as we've moved many of these processes, which previously were things that run in test tubes and were analog processes, to digital processes that are addressable with massive computing power and can be simulated, that makes it much harder for the law to keep up with the pace of change.
Hey, Jeff, I want to turn the tables on you for a second. Can I do that?
Sure.
I want to ask you a question. You know, with gene editing, CRISPR-Cas9, as it's called, we can now edit human life itself. And the Chinese have demonstrated that they can edit embryos. So let's say we're 5 or 10 years from now, and your daughter or your granddaughter or your wife or your daughter is pregnant, and the doctor does a blood test and says that the child is going to have a debilitating disease, that the child will be crippled for their whole life. On the other hand, if you take this pill, you can cure it. You're going to be editing the embryo and edit out the disease. Would you agree to that?
I believe I would, and you bring this up in the book as well. It's a question between whether you fix the things that are broken versus then do you also take a pill to make somebody smarter or faster?
Exactly. That was going to be my next question. Now you can add IQ points. How many IQ points do you want? 10, 20, 50? And the question is, if you add all this IQ, are you now altering humanity itself? These are choices we're going to have to make in the late 2020s. It's not that far off, but this is where we're headed. So forget about our policymakers. I'm putting you on the spot, saying if you were now the president of the United States, what choice would you make when it came to the policy? And it becomes very difficult because we don't understand the implications of all this.
Right. So it ends up being a series of individual decisions, like what would I do with my daughter or my wife versus what is the thing we should all be doing here? These are the issues raised in the book by Vivek Wadhwa and Alex Salkiever called The Driver in the Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create the Future. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone. Your thoughts about great developments in the world, bad developments in the world, how we tell them apart, 800-838-3760 by phone and by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Vivek, you do suggest asking three questions to assess value, and these are the final three portions of the book as well. What are those?
First of all, does the technology have the potential to benefit everyone equally? You know, go back to these LCM, go back to these dystopian movies, and go back to H.G. Wells and The Time Machine. It was always a case of the haves and the have-nots, and the have-nots ended up killing the haves because they were angry and they were left out. That's exactly what we don't want. We want to make sure that everyone benefits equally from technology. The second thing is, do the rewards outweigh the risks? I gave you the example of CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing. Well, in the case of editing out the hereditary disease, the rewards did outweigh the risks. But now, when you talk about adding IQ and adding features, enhancing strengths and so on, is it worth the risk that we're going to, you know, alter humanity itself? I don't know. The third thing is autonomy versus dependence. You know, all of us probably enjoy, you know, consuming alcohol every now and then. In California, my friends also consume marijuana. Now, to a limit, that's fine. It doesn't damage you. But once you cross the line, you become dependent on it, and it becomes dangerous. It's the same thing with technology. If we become dependent on our self-driving cars, we become dependent on gene editing, if we become dependent on our enhancements, it becomes a real problem. I mean, so we need to foster autonomy. We want independence. We want autonomy, not dependence. So those are the three filters that Alex and I looked at. We looked at every technology, tried to bring it to life and say, okay, here's what's going to happen with it, and here's the good and the bad. And then we said, okay, now you decide what the filter is, because ultimately it's not my choice, it's not your choice, it's not the President of the United States' choice. It's all of us who have to decide what the future should be.
Just an aside to the listeners, when we talk about CRISPR, we're not talking about the place where you get your lettuce crispy. We're talking about clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats, which is a way of editing gene segments to get very, very precise disconnections and reconnections and measurements. So obviously the book is called The Driver and the Driverless Car. So the driverless car makes appearances several times in the book. And for those of us who live not close to the Bay Area, Alex, how common are driverless cars now?
They're still not super common, but almost everyone I know has seen one. Because it, particularly down in Mountain View, Silicon Valley, you know, some up in San Francisco, you know, these companies are training them aggressively out on the road. There's always a driver in them right now, of course, because I mean, that's the law. You can't actually have them driving with nobody in them yet. But I mean, this is something that is becoming, particularly in Mountain View, California, around Google and up the road, you know, around Palo Alto, it's something you might see two or three times a week. You know, and it almost becomes part of your daily existence. The first time you see it, it is kind of shocking, you know, because literally the person is in the car, but their hands aren't necessarily on the wheel, and it's pretty clear that they're not doing anything, and the car is driving itself. And you're just like, wait a second, this looks pretty weird. But as it sinks in and as you get used to it, it starts to feel more, you know, like you're looking at something that's, I don't know, a taxi cab or a golf cart or something that's a little different. And that's just the Google cars, which are really small and bulbous. They come in all different flavors. And ultimately, there'll be aftermarket kits that we'll be able to put on most modern cars to turn them all into self-driving cars.
All right, so the book is all about technology and responses to it and the choices that we make about that. And there is a story here about people flinging feces at a Google bus in a protest. What was happening there, Alex?
So that was a slightly different thing, but related. In that case, in San Francisco and around the Bay Area, many of the larger tech companies have their own transportation infrastructure. So they send buses around the city to pick up their employees and get them down to their offices in Mountain View or in the south of the city, Genentech, a very large biotech does that, for example. Facebook does this too, I believe, to get people down to Menlo Park. In the cities, in particular places like the Mission in San Francisco and Oakland, many of the rents and the prices have gone up so dramatically, driven by the technology development and you know, the rising salaries of the cities, that a lot of the older, not older, but old-time residents in these communities, which, you know, aren't technologists, they may be artists or they may be service workers or maybe in other fields, they can't afford it anymore. So it's a manifestation of the haves and the have-nots and the gentrification and the costs that are levied on a place by technology. Now, in that particular case, it was a fairly extreme reaction, but it's an ongoing conversation throughout San Francisco, and I might add in places like New York, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., you know, London, and Berlin.
In the sense that the people are being conveyed on a conveyance that is not open to the public?
Well, or that technology is creating, and technology companies are creating a separate existence for their employees. Mm-hmm. And in radically altering the fabric of these places in a way, without necessarily asking permission of the longtime residents, you know, in doing things or sort of creating remaking the world in a way that they want that may not be the best for everybody.
Okay.
We're actually creating a gap here in Silicon Valley itself with these spoiled rich brats and the rest of society. You know, I'm putting it diplomatically. But the fact is that we now have we have problems here in the Silicon Valley itself. The place which is creating the future is also leaving behind people, and those people are rightfully getting angry and resentful about being left behind.
So let's talk about being left behind, because one of the first things you talk about in the book is a computer that composes music, and ultimately gets to the question of, is there really any job that cannot be automated, Vivek?
That really, really worries me, because when I look at it, if I move forward 10 or 15 years, I see robots now serving us, when we go out for dinner. I see robots within the house. I see digital doctors. I see, imagine Siri now dispensing medical advice. She watches over you 24/7 and she gives you advice. I see automation now doing the work that lawyers can do, that, most professions being automated. So what do human beings do? It terrifies me. I don't know. I don't have the answer.
All right. We'll keep trying to come up with some answers when we come back from this break. We're talking to Vivek Wadhwa and Alex Salkiever, the authors of The Driver and the Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create the Future. And we're talking about, individual choices and maybe some step back and look at the big picture kind of thinking. You can join us on The Exchange by phone or by email. We'll come back and take your calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Okay, we'll skip the rest of the introduction to the Jetsons family, but maybe you recognize that from growing up as a kid. It's one of our visions of the future, and we have lots of them over the years. We're talking about what we're going to do with the future with Vivek Wadhwa and Alex Salkiever. Vivek is the principal author of The Driver and the Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create the Future. Join the discussion on The Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we don't have all the gadgets of the Jetsons, although we do have Zumbas to vacuum the house, although you pointed out some problems with that in the book, Vivek. You do talk about the Siris and the other devices around the house that can answer questions or turn on other gadgets. You call that narrow AI. Why, Vivek?
Because, when we've been hearing about artificial intelligence since we were young. We saw science fiction, R2-D2, and all of these, these lifelike, robots. That's still the stuff of science fiction. What artificial intelligence today is really, it's like Excel, spreadsheets on steroids, that they're able to analyze massive amounts of data very fast to the point that they seem more intelligent than humans. It's not more intelligent. Today's AI is simply able to compute data faster than we can, and it looks very intelligent. But what happens is that the way you train these computers is by mimicking the brain. It's called a neural network where it learns by itself by looking at more and more data. The question that, this is the difference between the narrow AI and the what's called the artificial general intelligence. This is now the stuff from science fiction, the R2-D2s and Samantha from the movie Her and so on. This is when the tools, the technology begins to learn on its own. It decides what it wants to learn, starts learning, and now we don't even understand what it knows. So it's a different life form which seems intelligent by our standards. So this is where we're headed. And then there's this crazy stuff, artificial superintelligence, which is what Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking have been warning us about, saying this is when it goes crazy, that AI learns on its own. Now, AGI, artificial general intelligence, and superintelligence are all science fiction. I wouldn't scare everyone with them right now. Let's keep it as science fiction for now. But today, if you look at Alexa, if you look at Amazon Home, they're really smart. They are able to answer intelligent questions. Siri, to me, is still dumb. I mean, she's still a baby, whereas the others have grown up.
All right, let's take some calls here. We have, not surprisingly, a few people interested in talking about the future and how we get there. Let's start with Kathy and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Vivek Wadhwa and Alex Salkiever.
Hi, thanks for another great program.
Thank you.
I was, everything that we're talking about here, we're talking about the built environment.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole other thing going on, which is the natural environment. And in fact, people living such as myself who are studying organic farming and trying to protect the forests and what's left of old growth and so forth, our lives actually are filled with potential work and activities, say, restoring what was lost or certainly protecting stuff that we don't even understand, involved in tremendous battles around Oregon to try to protect what's left of the old-growth forests, for example. And we don't even know what's out there as far as the value, the wisdom of nature, and so forth. And with organic farming, there's a lot of, you know, people needed out.
You know, I wish there were more people like you, because that's the future I see, where we have time to clean up the world and to you know, do good things to uplift humanity. You know, because again, in the future we're headed to, we'll have more time to do organic farming. We'll have more time to help each other. We'll have more time to tend to the planet. So that's the Star Trek future I see. Great people like you doing good things for the world.
But you know, aren't we talking about things that John Kenneth Galbraith talked about something like 90 years ago, that there wouldn't be enough work to go around, so we could all kind of work part-time and we'd have so many machines to do things for us that we could take it a lot easier than we did? And it hasn't happened.
Yeah, it hasn't happened so far. That doesn't mean it won't happen in the future. If you look at the convergence of all these technologies that are written about, that you know, talk about AI, robotics, network sensors, medicine, etc., you see that they're all now on these exponential curves, and they're converging, and they're making the impossible possible. The science fiction we've been dreaming about for hundreds of years is finally happening. It's you know, the fact that we're now connected the way we are, the fact that we have these smartphone devices on which we can watch video, talk to each other, and so on. This is out of the Jetsons. I mean, you know, we take for granted that we have FaceTime on our iPads and we can talk to each other. That's what the Jetsons had. This stuff is happening.
Yeah, I remember all those years that we talked about video phones starting in the 1960s, and they were clunky and hard to use. And then all of a sudden, boom, they're there on our cell phones, what felt like overnight. Let's take another call from Chris in Wairika. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Vivek Wadhwa and Alex Salkiever.
Hi, very interesting programs, and I don't doubt for an instant that what you're talking about being able to happen could happen. I think my, you know, forecast into the future, you know, well, two things. One is that basically it's going to be an ugly transition getting to that future. I think we're in the, you know, beginnings of potentially, you know, climate change, which could, you know, drastically affect civilization across the planet as we know it. So, I mean, I don't doubt that we can deal with that in a technological way at some point, but it might be involve a lot of, you know, suffering before we get there. And the second thing is regarding AI, I actually think, you know, when I look into the future, I sit there and say, well, you know, if these, you know, machines basically can think for themselves at some point, maybe they're going to be smart enough to do some of the things we can't do, like control population size. And maybe we have a world in which the machines are actually controlling us because things just run a lot smoother that way. So, and I guess the last point would be human nature. Again, you know, there's always going to be those that, you know, have the power and don't want to let it go. And so human nature seems to be, you know, inequitable. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a hard struggle to overcome that.
All right. Thanks for the thoughts, Chris. Appreciate that. Vivek, one of the points that he brings up, that this idea that maybe the machines will be smarter than us and figure out how to take care of the planet better than we do. It sounds like cutting us out of the equation. What would you think about a future like that?
It's scary. I don't want the machines telling us what to do. What Ray Kurzweil believes is that we'll become one with those machines, that we'll use the AI to enhance us, and we'll give it our good judgment. But you know, the other point here is that there is a race between the destruction of the planet and saving it. Because I talk about this era of unlimited clean energy because I already live in it. I live in Menlo Park, California, in what's called a passive home. It's constructed so it consumes little energy. I have solar panels. I drive an electric vehicle. My energy bills are practically zero. About $500 a year is what I spend all inclusive on all of my energy. If I had one more solar panel, I would be living for free. Now, with the cost of solar dropping 15 to 20% every year, if you just look forward 5 or 10 years, it's going to be inexpensive, and we'll be able to start replacing en masse the fossil fuel economy with this clean energy economy. So I see us, ourselves, human beings, being able to save us in the next decade or so.
I want to take another call here. Let's go to Byron in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Vivek Wadhwa and Alex Salkiever.
Did you say Byron?
I did. Oh, Byron.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, good morning. I love this conversation, and I'm number of thoughts. One is that we have an inverse relationship between how much money people are paid for their work and how much it's worth to us. We have people that are taking care of old folks in homes that are making minimum wage, and we have people who are running hedge funds who extract millions of dollars out of running people out of their homes by the thousands. So the economy works against us, but the technology can work for us. I'm so impressed with what India is doing with providing electricity to rural areas. And the revolution in cell phone technology all around the world is going to open up all kinds of new cultural advances in third world situations. Meanwhile, we have, if you ever get on the YouTube and look at the First World Woes, there's a whole series of very funny things about first worlders who are, you know, so frustrated they have to walk across the room to get something. They're all this. So I think we're on the crux of a time when humanity has the chance to really move into a future of ease and abundance and friendliness and peace and security for people on a widespread basis. And we have the possibility of running us into yet another big war over oil or some sort of silly thing like that. And so I have tremendous hope, but the negativity bias keeps drawing us back down into cruddy situations. And I think there's a chance spiritually for us to acknowledge that the work ethic that has drawn us into jobs that destroy us can be changed so that we have a work ethic that provides sustainable ongoingness for us while providing us with time for naps and making love and making art and having a life instead of being just productive.
All right. Thanks for the thoughts on that, Byron. But that does scare us, doesn't it, Vivek, the idea of having that much free time? And because we just talked about the fact that you gain a lot of purpose and identification from your work. What do you do is the first question.
You know, that's, again, my worry, that we're not ready for this future in which we have all this abundance of time. And we haven't developed the new society in which we don't value people for how much money they have, but which we value people on for what they do. I mean, for, you know, for their musical capabilities, for their contribution to humanity itself. That's the future I want, in which we, you know, we respect people for caring for the environment, for caring for the elderly, for uplifting mankind. Those are the people I want to, you know, be looking up to, not people who just happen to get lucky, these young spoiled brats who happen to, you know, create an app which went viral and they made $1 billion on it. Forget those guys. Those are not the ones I respect. I respect the people who are uplifting humanity.
Okay, spoiled brats twice now. You're getting your level of anger there.
I live in Silicon Valley. I live in Silicon Valley here in Menlo Park. So what do you expect?
So for a guy who works at universities, though, Vivek, you're very hard on education. What do you see us doing wrong, and what do you see it turning into in the future?
Well, education today is the same as it's been for the last 200 years or so. You have a teacher that gets in front of a bunch of students. Instead of having chalk and slate, we now have slick PowerPoints. It really hasn't changed. Now, the last 5 years or so, something did change in that we went from now, doing exams and having children, you know, having to work on their own to now having them collaborate with each other. So they connect with each other on social media. They use email and send texts and so on. So that changed. But that's nothing. What I see in the next 5 or 10 years is an entirely new system of education in which the role of the teacher itself changes. The teacher becomes a coach. And the knowledge transfer happens through technology. Imagine learning about ancient Greece by getting into a virtual reality world in which you are in ancient Greece. Imagine learning Spanish or French by speaking to people in their native countries in those languages. Imagine learning how to build learning mathematics by building pyramids. Well, the virtual reality holodecks that are coming. Already you can buy these devices, but they're not very good yet. They will be in the next 4 or 5 years. Imagine getting your education, the knowledge transfer done that way, And the role of the teacher becomes the guru, the coach, basically teaching us social values, helping us work together, and helping us build our morals and ethical values. So that's what I see changing in education.
Alex, I want to bring you back in here because I want to talk about security and privacy, because these are always ongoing concerns as we talk about a future where we have computers and machines in our lives more. Have we already volunteered too much to the likes of Facebook, do you think?
So my personal view is yes, we have. I'm speaking for myself, not for Mozilla or Firefox. We have a very robust policy group, and they have lots of thoughts on this stuff. But yes, I personally am not comfortable with the idea that facial recognition is applied broadly across photo streams at Facebook without necessarily sufficient warning. I'm not comfortable with the fact that my kids' pictures might appear in social media when they're two and they don't have control over their online existence for the rest of their lives. It's basically lost. I'm also very uncomfortable with the idea that unseen forces can determine what content I see, what information I see, what is in my bubble. I want to control that. I think that that's a human right. I think we all should have that control. And with regard to privacy, I think that that's something that should also be a much stronger human right. We should all have the right to determine what information of ours, which is collected online, is held or shared or sold.
All right. Again, the three questions that Alex and Vivek recommend asking of new things is, one, does the technology have the potential to benefit everyone equally? Two, what are the risks and the rewards? And three, does the technology foster autonomy or dependency? You can find out more by reading the book and thinking about the things that come down the road in front of you. The book is called The Driver in the Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create the Future. Vivek Wadhwa with Alex Salkiever, the authors. Thank you both for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you for having us. It was an amazing conversation.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much.